In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to In the Thick of It, our weekly podcast where we discuss all the most interesting news, gossip, thoughts, etc. that we've had and heard this week. My name's Galen Stobbs. I'm the editor of Profit and Loss. With me, as always, is Colin Lambert, our managing editor. To kick us off this week, Colin, I actually wanted to share with you some feedback from a podcast we did 2 weeks ago where we talked about NDFs and in particular LATAM NDFs. I quickly got an email from someone not telling us that we got it all wrong, I hasten to point out, merely pointing out they felt that there were maybe a couple of points that we'd overlooked when we were talking about NDF electronification. In particular, they were kind of drawing on why Asian NDFs have become or trade electronically so much more than the LATAM ones do. So the first point they were saying that is just that Asian NDFs is just a much more globally traded product than LATAM, which is like localized, right? There's a little bit out of New York, maybe a tiny bit out of London or Spain, but it doesn't really trade the way Asian ones do globally, right? There's plenty of Asian NDF trading from New York. Another point they wanted to make was that LATAM NDF.
Sorry, before you do that, though, mate, is that a reflection, though, of? I mean, obviously, there's more global trade comes out of Asia, so there's going to be a little bit more sort of data backing that up. So I totally get that, and I think just generally the infrastructure is more developed there. But do you think it's actually just a question of the market makers being comfortable with the Asian NDFs? Because, you know, it's the whole thing about the electronification, liquidity begets liquidity. So it's just that it so happens that two or three of the bigger market makers in this place chose Asian NDFs first? Or do you actually think it is, you know, a genuine reflection upon, you know, global trade and the fact that, you know, people are just more focused on Asia?
So both. And we're going to, this is a later point, we're going to get to a point about making prices in LATAM NDFs compared to, but I think certainly global trade is part of it. And also when you look at just the sheer volume of NDF trading in general, right? Like I can't remember the exact percentage, but it's heavily skewed towards Asia in terms of just the overall NDF market. Yeah. Which brings on to the next point, which is, you know, when you talk about LATAM NDFs, there's kind of, they were saying there's Brazil and everything else, right? And in the same way, because again, even when you talk about LATAM NDFs versus Asian NDFs, it's kind of Brazil makes up the vast majority of the NDF trading in LATAM. And the benchmark for FX in Brazil is, of course, BM&F Bovespa, the exchange there.
Yeah.
Like, it's heavily futures traded, exactly, right? So you've got that in Brazil where you've got, like, a lot of electronic data, but it's coming from the exchange, from the futures market. But then, by contrast, when you're looking at Chile, Colombia, even kind of, I mean, Peru and Argentina, probably smaller, the onshore spot market, you know, it only trades for, you know, 4 or 5 hours per day, they were saying. And more importantly, the data there is very isolated in the sense that it doesn't leave the country very easily in real time,
which makes
it obviously more problematic for the NDF side.
Which is an infrastructure issue as well.
Oh, completely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Another issue is, of course, for LATAM NDFs, they're trading in Asian hours, that they're CEF-traded instruments, some of these. And yes, the big institutions down there and the big firms that trade it are all going to be swap dealers. But then for anyone who's below that category, you know, it's, you know, do you have the right, you know, regulatory designation? Are you onboarded to CEF? That element comes into play a bit. And finally, linking back to the point you made earlier about, you know, the liquidity providers, you know, in Brazil, they pointed out, it's very easy because a lot of its trading occurs on BM&F. It's easy to provide two-way prices, particularly, you know, you get non-banks that are very active in the region. But if you're market making in Chilean, Colombian currencies, it's a lot more tricky because, you know, during the U.S. hours, they don't have anywhere really to exhaust that risk. So a lot of it's happening still RFQ, not two-way prices. And so that's what they were saying was kind of another key issue, right? Which is you don't have this two-way pricing. It's not so much streaming. And that's why we haven't seen it electronify at the same pace as Asia. So those are just kind of a few differences that they wanted to highlight, which is why, you know, NDFs in Asia have lent themselves to becoming more electronic, partially because they're more involved in that global market.
I also think, I mean, ultimately what we've just discussed there is just the problem that permeates everything in markets at the moment is data. The key to it is data. Because these markets, particularly the non-bank market makers and the electronic market makers, you know, I mean, we forget that in a lot of this chat room stuff that happened a few years ago, quite a lot of the traders involved were trading LATAM currencies in New York. And, you know, they're on the chat, they were trying to, and it's a very, as you say, it's a very small market, and that creates problems. It creates a problem of trust. And therefore, you know, naturally people, their response was, okay, let's try and electronify this. And then they go to and go, but there's no data. Coincidentally, of course, we've got a futures exchange in Brazil. There's plenty of data for them to use. Once the data builds, you'll get these guys willing to make more rates, I guess. So it's a chicken and egg situation, isn't it? You know, you can't get the data without the trading, but you won't get the trading without the data. So it'll be interesting to see, because, I mean, without a natural economic boost to activity, you know, such as you have in Asia with the growth of China and stuff like that, I'm wondering how they really do get a greater electronification of LATAM NDFs. It could be, we could be sitting here in 2 years' time, and it hasn't actually moved on. It, you know, might be something to watch, I suppose. You know, it's
no, that's a great
point.
It'll
be an interesting one. Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll just have to wait and see, you know, as always. While we're on the subject of electronic trading, it's the time of the year when everyone comes to Sydney for conferences. Literally, we get nothing. It's feast or famine. You get nothing for, like, you know, months on end, and then three come along at once. There's actually two competing conferences next week in Sydney. But yesterday I went to the FIX Markets Conference, which is generally electronic trading. Its genesis was in equities. Yeah, I mean, I have to say I enjoy the conferences. They get some good speakers on there that are part of the FIX community, because it's like a trade association in its own way. You know, they have members and they're member firms and so on. But it's always a really good thing to tap into what the equity markets are thinking in terms of electronic trading data. The first thing that struck me yesterday was, you know, panels on data and AI and liquidity. I'm thinking, yep, reminds me of Forex Network Chicago last month. And I guess the other thing that struck me as well was how these guys are talking very similar themes to FX, whereas a few years ago, they weren't. There are differences, though. I mean, the thing that struck me, I guess, from there was a really good panel on liquidity and transparency. And I've got a bunch of traders, and there was a buy-side traders session at the end as well, and they were saying the same thing. They're stressing the importance of dark liquidity. So on one hand, you've got like these asset managers saying, no, I need dark liquidity is really important when I want to block trade and so on, which we've all known. I mean, you know, it's one of my oldest things in the world. If total transparency is such a great idea, why is 30% of NYSE equities traded on the dark pool? Because that's what the customers want. So the customers up there going like, no, you know, we get the lit markets and we get that, you know, costs in MiFID have come down. There was a really good graphic representation of how costs have gone down post-MiFID. But so you've got the asset manager saying, look, no, I like dark liquidity because, as we discussed previously, I've got this information leakage. I'm getting signaling risk. I'm getting front run to a degree by, you know, small firms. So they want the dark liquidity, and they're stressing the importance of this. On the same panels, you've got regulators and tech firms saying, no, it's all about the transparency. And so I found it quite strange that they were having this discussion, because my impression was that they equity markets were slightly in front of FX on some of this stuff. Clearly they're not, because I think FX has nailed it pretty well with the global code. It's about transparency of action, not transparency of order. These people were sort of having that problem. They were also talking about the challenges in finding true liquidity in the era of fragmentation. Again, post-MiFID, fragmentation of venues, a lot more venues open up, and they're saying it's really difficult to try and find, you know, what is the true liquidity, which kind of bemused me a little bit, because I'm thinking, they don't have last look. Surely if the price is there. But then this is a point, I guess, that's been made, you know, before, is that if you trade on a firm liquidity venue, like, you know, EBS Market, Reuters Matching, or sorry, Refinitiv Matching, and LMAX, for example, you don't have rejections, but you do have mistrades. You know, you click, if the market makers that click, I think I said 2 weeks ago, you know, 99% of limit order trades to EBS are cancelled. So these guys are sort of saying they're having this problem as well in equities. And like, well, how do I find real liquidity? And a lot of the time they're going back to RFQ. I mean, they showed there was a good example of someone using a bot on Symphony to take broker expressions of interest, which was actually, I mean, you looked at it and thought, that is a real, really good use of AI. I'll come back to that in a second. And I guess the other thing they were looking at is that these guys are still fixated on top of book, which I think highlights the different market structures. Because, you know, anyone can tell you in an OTC market that, you know, particularly when you've got small size at top of book, often it's better just to totally ignore that, leave that alone, because otherwise you are going to get slippage. I mean, there is going to be a cost of execution. And I guess my final point from it was the traders were getting a lot of grief from their portfolio managers about the cost of execution, and this is grief they didn't get 2 years ago when the portfolio managers didn't care. So it was interesting to see that suddenly they're talking about things that FX were discussing maybe 3-4 years ago.
So I wanted to ask you about that, which is because I think we've talked about this before, and I think we did like a session, I think it was in one of our New York conferences a few years ago, where we talked about the kind of the technology food chain, right? And this was particularly when everybody was moving to like a FIC structure within their businesses. And so we were kind of looking at, okay, so what kind of is and isn't FX kind of taking from equities and adapting, and then what from FX do we see actually being taken and kind of applied to fixed income? And that's where we were talking about this kind of technology food chain. I mean, do you think then that kind of idea of it kind of progresses from one market to the other is beginning to break down a bit? Or was it never really accurate to begin with?
I'm not sure it was ever totally accurate to begin with. I think it was, a mantra of certain interests in the FX industry that it suited their book to get us talking more about, you know, moving to that equities exchange, truly transparent type of model. The fact is an ECN is a de facto exchange. It's just the structure behind it that's different. I think not only is it not happening, I actually think it's reversing. I think, you know, it's quite interesting now, you know, whereas 2-3 years ago at this conference, it was, you'd go in and think, oh, okay, I don't think FX has thought about that one. And don't get me wrong, there was some really thought-provoking stuff came out of this conference yesterday that I want to go and look into further, particularly around the AI space. But no, I think actually, you know, you've got equity markets now talking about speed bumps, you know, artificial speed bumps and latency floors. You know, they're worried about fragmentation. They're stressing the importance of being able to execute off exchange. This is FX stuff from 2-3 years ago that we were going through then. You know, the smart firms were, to be fair, there are still firms out there now just coming around to the realization that, you know, just slamming top of book ends up with slippage. So I actually think, yeah, it's an interesting one. My instinct is it's actually kind of reversing, and that the equities markets globally are now looking to something like FX for some of their ideas to make it a fairer marketplace, because I think it's been an unfair marketplace for quite a few years now. And I don't want to say all Michael Lewis about this, but, you know, the fact is there has been, you know, information advantages and speed and technology advantages that the market structure there really helped. And if that doesn't get the equities people ringing my bell, I don't know what will. One thing I wanted to ask you actually was on the AI piece is. Just as I say, there was this really interesting sort of presentation, and it was about brokers, i.e. banks, sending their expressions of interest in stocks to the traders, and it would take like, you could, you know, the person said it could take 10 minutes for the stock, for the trader to go like, okay, so, you know, the broker says we're selling, you know, we're a seller of BHP stock, and it would take 10 minutes for the trader to work through everything. Okay, do we need BHP? No. Do we need, have we got anything correlated there? Have we got any of this? They've now got bots immediately answering the chat, saying, okay, Mom, please check in. And I think they said about 95% of the time they go back saying, sorry, we actually don't have any interest in this. The trader hasn't even seen it. But what happens when the trader, when the bot goes, oh, actually, we might have an interest in BHP, you know, because we've got an interest in that stock, or because there's a, you know, we're in the correlated market, it then refers it to the trader, like trader intervention, which I thought was a really good example of how AI is saving traders' time. Yeah, I mean, literally, it's gone from, they're saying it's gone from like the 10 to 15 minute workflow to 1 minute for the trader, and then it becomes a negotiation phase. So I thought that was good. What? Go on.
You think it's great? I think this is how Skynet starts.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, we've had that discussion before as well, haven't we? You know, what stage does Arnie show up?
Yeah.
We all run for the hills. I mean, I kind of like that. I mean, I thought, you know, as a trader, particularly when you're dealing with thousands of instruments, it's different for, you know, a spot trader. You know, I'm a bear of little brain. I traded one, maybe like two markets. I mean, you know, I had to go on the ERM desk in the early 90s. You know, bloody hell, there's like, you know, there's like 10 currencies here. What am I meant to, how am I meant to keep track of all those? You know, I'm used to trading one. But when you're trading in like literally thousands of products, as, you know, as a stock trader is, I looked at that thinking it was really good. What worried me and what I wanted your thoughts on, though, was they were starting to talk about commoditization of AI. As in, you know, like, let's try and narrow this down a bit to make sure that we're looking. I get we need to look at the right data, but they were saying, oh, well, if we can get these practices across the industry, then that would really help. I'm interested in your thoughts on, to the example I just gave, I think that's fine. But if that continues further in and we get more commoditization of AI, I start getting worried. What do you think?
Why? I don't get worried. As long for relatively utility purposes like that.
I'm fine with that, but it's what happens next.
But what are you worried about happening next? I don't see where the slippery slope you're suggesting is sliding to.
Well, I never was a skier anyway, but as anyone that's seen me in the flesh will know. I guess what worries me is they're talking about commoditization of the data and how they're processing the data. To me, that ends up with crowded trades, and I just don't see the value. And I think then you get, A, it will mean people wasting a lot of money on something that I don't think actually does any good, and B, you do end up at Skynet where everything has to go logical, and markets are not logical beasts. They never have been. They're psychological beasts. And it worries me that people want to suddenly say, okay, well, we're all going to use AI for the same purposes.
Yeah, but surely if everybody's buying the same AI solution off the shelf to analyze data and crunch numbers and spit out information for them, then simply the winner will be the person that's smarter and does something slightly more sophisticated than the off-the-shelf thing, and the people who are getting stuck in crowded trades will just get weeded out. I know.
Yeah, okay, I kind of get that. Actually, I think what it comes down to is the person who's fastest will succeed, and then we're back to a speed game and a technology arms race, which, again, will start impacting the smaller players in markets. And I don't think that's healthy for markets. Yeah, we automatically turn into a speed game, because if it becomes a crowded trade, then there's going to be money to be made for the first people into it. And ultimately, of course, everyone will realize this is going on, and then you'll get the counter traders, and it might balance itself out. But I think what we'll do, we'll end up getting a lot of very short, nasty short-term moves. And I guess my question is there a ceiling on how we – do you think there's a natural ceiling on where using AI in financial markets – is efficient?
Pr- Perhaps, but I don't know where the ceiling is yet. And my feeling is that it's such early days and we're so scratching the surface. And again, as we talked about before, AI is a pretty blanket term, right? I think it's too early days for us to really start talking about ceilings for AI usage just yet.
Okay, that's fine. I've never been scared of an early prediction.
Did you ever see that film Margin Call, by the way, which was about financial crisis? Yeah, right, when the character, because it reminded me there when I was saying like, oh, someone will come up smarter and you said they'll be faster. And then the character is talking about how there's three ways to make money in finance. Be smarter, be quicker, or cheat.
Yes. Well, I guess the good thing about the AI world is it's going to be a lot harder to cheat. And I noticed that the DOJ charged three former Tower research traders for spoofing on, I think it was Monday, so it would have been, it might have been the weekend in the US. And I guess, yeah, this is what the exchanges and what the regulators are using. They're using AI to actually spot these illegal trading patterns. So actually, maybe in the future, AI will help us get to the stage where the only way to make money is to be cheaper or, you know, or quicker. I'm just not keen on the idea of speed winning everything.
And talking about your transparency point from earlier, in Stockholm we had a trading firm that uses a lot of AI tools who was speaking, and we were talking about kind of transparency in relation to data, and he was kind of making the point that, like, again, everybody thinks of it as this kind of black box where you feed data in and it starts trading and trade ideas come out. But he was like, the reality is if I really need to kind of show people exactly like why a trade was made at this point, what the kind of the logic behind it was, I have all this data I can point to. I can justify everything that happens throughout the entire trade. So actually kind of the use of AI, far from being this kind of mystical, hard to comprehend thing, actually becomes, I can break this down into minute detail, and at that point it becomes far more transparent and logical.
And that's to my earlier point about where I think FX has got it right and X's hasn't quite got it right yet. You're talking there about transparency of action, not transparency of order. And to me, that's where I think transparency should be. So, I mean, you know, let's face it, we're going to be talking about AI a lot more over the coming years because it's still a buzzword. And, you know, you're right, we'll get into deep learning at some stage. It's just deep learning and Colin Lambert have never been words said in the same sentence before. And I'd rather it stays that way for a little while longer. In other big news this week, I wrote a story about crypto.
I know you did, Colin.
Obviously, I copied and pasted it. Didn't understand a word of it, but yeah. No, I mean, the news that Fidelity are opening up, you know, custody solutions and a dedicated crypto service for their customers, I actually thought was quite interesting. I mean, I'm sure you've got some thoughts on it in terms of the more general, detailed aspects of it and what it can mean for the industry. But I guess my top level thought was, if you get customers like Fidelity going into crypto, there are a lot of banks out there arming and ahhing about whether they want to be in crypto. If you get firms like Fidelity going in, I wonder, does that drag the banks in? You know, inevitably, because, you know, I'm a bank. I listen to my customers. I do everything my customers want, even if they tell me to jump
customer
off the
cliff. Customer-centric. You know, our customer-centric
exactly,
approach.
Exactly, I'm a client-centric, customer-focused organization. And my customers are now trading crypto. Well, you know, providing crypto, does that drag me in? What's your thoughts?
So a few things. Firstly, I wasn't that surprised by the Fidelity announcement. I might have even mentioned it on one of our podcasts a while back, which was I was having a conversation with someone who's from the FX world and I would say fairly cynical or certainly level-headed. He's not a crypto evangelist. And they were telling me that they'd been in the Fidelity labs recently and they said some of the stuff they're working on there is incredible. And they said,
and they've been mining Bitcoin for 3 years, haven't they?
Yeah, and Abigail Johnson, the CEO and chairwoman, is a big kind of advocate. She's been interested and engaged in the space for a long time. But the person that was saying to me that they said to me this was a while ago, they're going to have a custody solution before the end of the year, and they said some of the stuff they're working on is really clever and technical and very brilliant. They were very impressed, and this was from kind of a fairly cynical. Mm. FX background. So I think that's interesting. I've had more than one person say to me this week that this is kind of a big announcement for them. I think, will this drag the banks in? I don't know if this is going to speed up, realistically, if this is actually going to speed up the banks coming in. What it will do is it will make things much easier for a lot of the buy side firms that are kind of teetering on the edge. When you have someone like this that's doing enterprise quality custody, yeah, trade execution services, etc., it's going to bring in those people more than the banks. The big banks, they've already got the wheels are in motion, but it's going to be a slow process, and they've already got their timeline and their plan for entering crypto, and I don't think a Fidelity announcement is really going to necessarily accelerate that. I think it could for certain buy-side firms, definitely.
But then if those other buy-side firms come in, does that not then ratchet up the pressure a bit more?
Oh, for sure. But I think that's why. Yeah. We had Mike Morrow from Genesis Trading, which is a crypto market making firm, at our Mexico conference. You know, he was saying the banks did not want to get into crypto. They did. You know, they shook their heads and they put their fingers in their ears and they said no, and they didn't want to. You know, they really did not want to be a part of it, right? And they've kind of been dragged kicking and screaming into all of this, right? And so I think that is inevitable. I spoke to someone who left a big bank to obviously start their own crypto firm, and they were just saying that the amount of reverse inquiry they were getting from customers every day about, how can you help me invest? What products do you have, et cetera, that pressure is already there. And yes, it will grow as more firms get into this. Interesting. It looks like another thing I noticed this week was that it looks like Brevan Howard has a crypto spin-off. Did you see that?
Oh, okay. No.
So I was going over some documents about some FCA website, some documents about a new firm started slightly earlier this year, and everybody listed on there is senior people at Brevan Howard or all kind of the officers and managers. So it looks, I've gone for confirmation, but they're being very tight-lipped about it. But it looks very much like it is a crypto spin-off.
And I guess, let's face it, it doesn't surprise, it shouldn't surprise us, should it? Because, you know, they're a trading firm, they're looking for alpha and anything they can, and crypto has been a source of alpha. In fact, I would argue, actually, that crypto markets now are probably even better suited to the hedge fund community than they were last year when it was just like rampaging north. There does seem to be a bit more liquidity. The markets do seem to be a little bit more settled, but within, you know, if you take a day or a week, there are plenty of opportunities to make, you know, 1 or 2%.
Yeah, I mean, I've posed this question to quite a few people, which is, you know, now that the kind of the excitement and the price is coming down, is it still as an attractive market for you and for, you know, other firms in the space? And everyone said, yeah, look, the price coming down and the volumes coming down and volatility coming down a bit might turn off some of the retail players, but the institutional players that have decided to make a play in this space aren't going to suddenly turn around and abandon this because the price has come down.
No, absolutely not. No. And that's the thing. This could actually be the thing that sort of drives this institutionalization that everyone's talking about in crypto, which they were talking about last night. Yesterday, by the way, this on the crypto session at this conference. I guess one other thing, just to kind of finish us off for this week, is it's something we've discussed, you know, offline, not on the podcast before, but I pointed out yesterday that it was 10 years this week that FX Market Space shut its doors, you know, the offspring of CME and Reuters. And actually, brilliantly, yesterday, so Reuters, then after FX Market Space was formed, Reuters became Thomson Reuters, and obviously earlier this month it became Refinitiv. And on stage yesterday, there was a guy talking, he was giving a presentation, and he went, and this data comes from Thomson Reuters, and just carried on. So, guys, you spent a lot of money for something that people can't actually pronounce. Even more brilliantly, as one of the sponsors of the conference, the big backdrop logo with the sponsors on it, still had Thomson Reuters on it. Someone didn't get that message through either. So there's some teething issues there. But yeah, to go back to FX market space, I wrote a thing. I've got some feedback which I'll share with you in a second or whatever. But obviously, I mean, it was an abject failure in the end. We've often sort of said, was it a solution that's was 5 years ahead of its time or 10 years of its time?
Right idea, wrong time, kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, and I guess, yeah, my point yesterday was it attracted the wrong sort of trading firm. And, you know, some of the feedback I got was they really needed to get two or three accounts on side, and they failed to do that. And there's a few other things about it. Yesterday, in the end, I was like, I'm not convinced that it would work today in spot markets, because I think, you know, even the way, because what it does, it gives people with speed advantages, that advantage, mm-hmm. and reinforces that with a credit solution that frees them up. And I just don't think, the non-bank firms don't want it. I mean, I actually made the point yesterday that I think one of the reasons it failed was because HFTs realized in FX the last people they want to deal with is other HFTs. But I mean, so what do you think? I mean, could it work now? I think it can in swaps, and that was my solution. That was my conclusion. What do you think?
I think it could. My sense is this was kind of before my time in FX, but I've spoken to people who were in and around then. I think part of the problem then was the bank non-bank relationship was a little bit more antagonistic back then.
Absolutely.
So my understanding was there was a lot of, you know, one side says give us this, and the other side says no, don't give them that. We don't. If you give them that, we're going to pull our support for you, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I think that was a bit of an issue, which I don't. The relationship there seems a lot more settled today on the bank non-bank side.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, I think that was my point yesterday. Is that what you had then was you had most of the non-bank firms were HFTs. In fact, pretty much they were all HFTs, and so they were directly antagonistic to the banks who hadn't, you know, at that stage hadn't spent a lot of money on their pricing engines because they hadn't needed to. You know, latency was a relatively new issue for these. They spent a lot of money on their nice shiny front ends for their single dealer platforms, but they hadn't. Most of them hadn't done anything about the pricing behind it, and they were obviously getting found out. So, absolutely. I mean, I think it's, you know, I think that was part of the problem. So that relationship between bank and non-bank is a lot more symbiotic now. But then I think the very fact that that is we haven't moved. Whilst the banks have taken some non-bank techniques in terms of, you know, quicker pricing and risk management, better use of data, the overall shift has been towards that bank model, that relationship model. And this wasn't a relationship problem.
True.
I agree. I look at it and go, I look at it and go, like, you know, in FX swaps, we keep on talking about getting a club that's centrally cleared for the major dealers. There you go. I guess the same issue could come up. You could end up attracting a lot of very small, high-frequency players to the FX swaps market, and then that becomes a real problem. So I guess that's one that you could debate forever and ever. But I think what we'll do, we'll just close out with one bit of feedback. I mean, I say one of my feedbacks was that, you know, it was about not attracting the bigger players, and they needed to change things 6 to 8 months into maybe go towards swaps. My favourite bit of feedback, though, was from someone who was working at FX Market Space at one stage.
And what did they say?
I got a very brief email this morning. He went, "Dude, that is more coverage of FXMS than you gave us when we were operating it. Enjoy reading it." And I'm sitting there thinking, that's probably a bit harsh, because we did give them some reasonable coverage, but actually, it's probably right. So on that note, on that positive, I think, feedback note, we'll end this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week as usual, and we look forward to speaking with you then. Cheers.